My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. As a boy growing up in the 50s and 60s, my family stressed the importance of gratitude. My siblings and I were taught to be truly thankful for everything in our lives. My father took ill when we were very young, and we did not have an easy life, but our gratitude for what we did have diminished any sense of lack or want. That same gratitude was shared by virtually everyone around us at that time. In today's stress-filled and divided world, gratitude seems to be put aside and in some instances forgotten. How important is it for each of us to look at our lives and feel and express genuine gratitude, both personally and as citizens of our country and our world? My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, cultural observer and theologian Diana Butler Bass, says that gratitude is central to both our personal and political lives, and that it may be the single most important spiritual practice we can engage in times of turmoil and conflict. Diana is the author of 10 books on American religion, politics, and culture, and comments widely in the media about faith and public life. She holds a doctorate in religious studies from Duke University, has taught at the college and graduate level, is currently an independent scholar, and teaches and preaches internationally on matters of religion and spirituality. She lives in Virginia with her family. Her website is dianabutlerbass.com, and she joins me this evening to discuss her new book, Grateful, The Transformative Power of Giving Thanks. Please join me in welcoming Diana Butler Bass. Good evening, Diana.
Good evening, Victor. It's really good to be with you, and I am always happy to talk about being grateful.
And I am grateful that you're joining us tonight, so thank you very much.
A circle of thanks.
There we go. So let's begin with your path and your personal story. Please share with us how you developed your interest in theology.
Oh, my goodness. That's a question that I haven't been asked in a long time. It was for me, to study theology was a natural thing. When I was a little girl, I was just full of questions about who God was and where God was and questions about meaning. But the most important set of questions that I think were the questions that eventually resulted in pursuing theology in school and in an academic way was when I was about, I think I was 11 maybe, I had this series of night terrors where I kept waking up and I was actually terrified of death. And I would scream. My mother would come into the room and she'd say, Why are you upset? Why are you crying? And I said, I'm afraid of dying. And there was this conversation I can still remember now. I'm in my late 50s of my mom sitting on the edge of my bed. And I said, I just can't imagine what it's going to be like to live in eternal nothingness. And my mother was a very wonderful woman and a Methodist, and her faith meant a lot to her. But she looked at me and she said, well, don't think about eternal nothingness, because when it happens, you won't know anything. And so basically my mother was just telling me, don't worry, you're just going to go into the void and you're not going to have any consciousness. And so just chalk it up to being human, you know, and that was her answer when I was 11 years old. And so I did not grow up in a home where it was like, oh, you're going to go to heaven and there's going to be your dog in a mansion and Jesus and all that kind of stuff. My mother was a much more sort of intellectually realistic person. And she didn't want to lead me on with something she worried that herself might be a fairy story. So she tells me about the extinguishment of consciousness.
Do you at 11 years old, why do you think that you had these terrors about passing and going into nothingness? Where do you think that came from?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. I've always been kind of theologically and philosophically very precocious. As I said a moment ago, you know, I was always interested in questions about meaning, even when I was teeny. And so there was some natural gene I must have had. Although, you know, later on, I can talk about it as being a kind of a natural gene. I actually do now think that there is something in our family histories that I call spiritual DNA. And I've done a lot of family history work in recent years. One of the things that I discovered is that many of my ancestors have been people who joined new religious movements very early in the life of those new religious movements. Mm. Yeah, it was a fascinating thing to discover, but you know, I thought my maiden name was actually Hochstedt. And if you have a German name like that, you just sort of assume that your family history was either Lutheran or Roman Catholic. And yet, when I did the family history, I discovered, I also took DNA tests, that the German part of my family is very small. Instead, the major part of my DNA comes from British Islands and especially the north of Scotland. And as I delved into that, I discovered that the first person in my family's line who came to the New World was a fellow from a little tiny village in Scotland. And part of the reason he left is he had become a Quaker. Mm. And the year was 1650 something. He was born 1652. And so he came before he was 20 to Maryland as a Quaker. And so that means he was a first generation Quaker. And so I found that out and I went, oh my gosh, that explains so much about my own impulses towards things that are actually very powerful in Quaker tradition, the belief in an inner light, the passion for justice, seeing all people as being fully equal in and through God. So they were Quakers, and then about 100 years later, they became Methodist, and that was another new religious movement at the time. And then about 150 years later, they became Pentecostals. Mm. And so this is just something my family does, apparently, is that they ask, questions. They don't accept sort of standard brand institutional answers. They apparently don't really like belonging to conventional institutions. And when something wanders by that presents a vision of God that is compelling and about experience and has some sort of sound to it that is new and opens the universe up to them with hope and joy, they appear to respond.
That's wonderful. So you had that experience when you were a child, and then what led to your pursuit of the degree in theology?
Well, I just went through school, and I really always enjoyed history, and I also enjoyed studying cultures and cultural change. So in high school, I took a lot of classes in social sciences and a lot of classes in history. Got to college, I majored in history and religious studies. And by that point in time, I was seriously thinking that I wanted to do higher level academic work and maybe even teach in religious studies. And so that's the path that opened for me. And I spent the first 14 years of my professional life, after I got a PhD in religion, teaching, and as a college professor, mostly undergraduates. And that was a great and amazing period of time in my life. I discovered if you can teach 18-year-olds theology and history of religion, especially the history of Christianity, and that they like it or they're interested in it, you could probably teach anybody just about anything.
There you go. That's the truth. And did you ever have a calling or a desire for ordination and becoming clergy?
I have not, which is an interesting piece of my own experience. I grew up in a time when there weren't very few women ministers, so I didn't have that as an example that was available to me. But it became an example as I was a young woman, and more of the denominations were opening up those pathways to women. So it was there as a possibility, but I just never felt the real profound calling to the pastoral aspects of that. Sitting with people in hospital or marrying and burying, as my classmates always used to say. So I don't really, I love beautiful liturgy, but I don't really like leading liturgy. And so if you don't like liturgy, you don't want to marry people, you don't want to do funerals, you're probably not called to be a pastor.
By the same token, one need not be ordained, though, to bring messages to people and to minister to them, right?
That's correct. And I preach all the time. And I do, despite the fact that leading liturgy makes me a little nervous, I certainly have done that in recent years. And I offer extemporaneous prayers, and I pray formal prayers. And I've certainly been involved in different kinds of public acts of spiritual healing and you know, like laying on of hands and things like that. So I, in a sense, I think that any of your listeners who may have grown up in Protestant tradition would certainly recognize that a deep part of Protestantism is this idea of the priesthood of all believers. And that is that every human being is essentially a priest. And I feel like I have a deep calling to that. So I don't need to have a collar, and I don't feel like I need the formal piece of paper that says that I can do certain things within the context of a denomination. But to claim that human priesthood as the proclamation of truly good news and participating in the constant creation of the world and the healing of the world, that's the priesthood that I'm part of.
Preaching from the pulpit of life, my guest, Diana Butler Bass. She's the author of the new book, Grateful, and we'll be back with more of Diana after these words on the Olden Times Radio Network.
Olden Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Olden Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Elia, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
The average time a resume spends on an HR manager's desk is 7 seconds, and most of them are tossed aside. Now imagine if one of those resumes belonged to Yasmin, who was
living in a shelter, juggling 3 jobs. I had to be resilient. That's something that you can't teach.
We rely so much on a resume, yet it could never tell the full story of someone who
had to be independent and take initiative, and that's how I handle every project I get.
Discover new ways to develop great talent at gradsoflife.org, brought to you by Grads of Life and the Ad Council.
When it comes to parenting, there are no perfect answers, but that's okay, because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information on adoption, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUS Kids, and the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this evening, Diana Butler Bass. She's the author of the book, Grateful, The Transformative Power of Giving Thanks. So, Diana, your last book from 2015, Grounded, Finding God in the World, A Spiritual Revolution, came in a time when there appeared to be a decline in traditional religion, but you countered that by saying it really was a change in how people were experiencing God. What did you find?
I have been fascinated in the last decade and a half by the statistics that show how people are leaving behind conventional forms of faith. And in some ways, that's not terribly unusual in American history. And I even just told a story about my own family being very willing to cast away institutional religion and pursue new kinds of religious movements. But the thing that's really different right now is that as people leave conventional kinds of organizations of religious life and conventional traditional formulations, is they're not necessarily going to anywhere new. Instead, people are describing themselves as spiritual but not religious or unaffiliated. So they're not leaving one thing to join something else. They're just leaving. And what if a lot of people who I work with, and I do work with an enormous number of people who are religious leaders, that they are actually in charge of denominations. And they're very upset, you know, at these kinds of trends. And they generally see them as a threat. And one of the things that I've been encouraging them to understand is that it's probably less of a threat and more of a critique. And that when people are willing to say, hey, I don't want to be a member of your group anymore, it can feel awful to the people who are still in the group. But it's also an invitation for the people within the religious traditions to re-examine what they're saying, what they're teaching, how they act. Are they being hypocrites about anything? Are there structural issues about their communities that are driving people away? Does their liturgy speak in beautiful and poetic ways that people need to hear now? And so I was in Grounded opening a conversation, one that valued how people were finding God in the world with neighbor and with nature. And so the book was divided into two parts, looking at how we discover God in the natural world and then how we discover God in the world of neighbors. So I was validating that search, and I was saying, yeah, if people find God in nature and neighbor, that's a good thing. And if they weren't finding God there, I would be really worried about where we were headed as a human race. And then there was this other part of it as well, where I was really hoping that people who care about these beautiful ancient religious traditions, which are the things that are embodied now within institutional religion, that they would hear this not as a threat to the future of religion, but that they would hear it as an invitation to a more open and lively and life-giving path that their traditions could take as we all walk into the future together. I think that some people I work with did hear it that way. So it was an interesting book. It was written to both people who had left religion behind and people who still cared about it. And it was implicitly a little thoughtful and perhaps edgy to those who are within conventional religion, but they engaged it. And it was very much also I considered it almost a hopeful song that I, as a parent, could sing with my own daughter, who has been a person who has found God in the natural world in very deep and beautiful ways. And so I could recognize how she was discovering God, and I could celebrate that with her.
You know, it's interesting. I had a conversation with a friend about his son is in his teens, approach to spirituality and faith. And he said something very fascinating to me. He said, of all the people in the world, he never expected his son to come to him and say, Dad, when I look at a leaf, or I look at a bird, or I look at something in nature, I see God, because look at the perfection, the way these things come together. And no person, no human mind could ever conceive or create what we have in nature. And it was really touching the way he expressed it to his father. Do you find that a lot with the younger people coming up now?
Oh, well, I do. And there was this really amazingly beautiful moment when my daughter was in her mid-teens. She grew up in the Episcopal Church, and that's still where our whole family's church membership is. And she knows, you know, priests and bishops and all kinds of sort of very important people within her own denomination. She knows the liturgy by heart. It was these were the religious words that shaped her whole formation of her childhood and her teenage years. She was confirmed in the Episcopal Church, and she chose to do that. So she gets to be, after confirmation, she's probably about 14 or 15 years old, and she started fighting with me about going to church. And I thought, oh no, I never wanted to have this argument with my own kid. You know, all of my friends have been through this, and I thought I was going to avoid it because she seemed to really enjoy church. So finally, I said, okay, I don't want to have a fight about this. Instead, I asked her the question. I said, honey, what is it that makes you not want to go to church? Because you always like church. And she said, well, you know, Mom, the worship doesn't really mean much to me. And I said, really? Even though you grew up on it? And she said, yeah, I just don't really find God there.
Mm.
And I thought, okay, I'm not going to lecture her. You know, this is the mom with the PhD in religion who's thinking, don't lecture your kid, you know, because I could tell her a thousand ways that she could find God in the liturgy. But instead, I resisted the temptation to lecture, and I asked her the question. I said, well, where do you find God? And she looked at me and she said, I find God when I'm hiking. And at that moment, I knew I had a choice. That as her mother, I could have wound up being the mother who says, well, that's fine. You can find God in the mountains all you like, but as long as you're living under my roof, you're going to go to the Eucharist on Sunday. Or I could learn to hike.
Mm.
And I could try to see what she saw in nature. And believe me, that was really hard for me because I have never really liked hiking. I was the little girl who was asking philosophical questions and liked being in libraries when I was growing up. But here was my daughter who was finding God in the mountains. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to learn how to hike. And that means I'm going to have to forget about the snakes and the bears and the fact that I hate bugs and I don't like walking when it's raining outside and all of that. And so I learned how to hike. And every other year, my family goes on a hiking trip to Wyoming out to the Wind River Range. And we spend up to 2, maybe 3 weeks sometimes out in the mountains, and we reconnect. And so then we also go on shorter hikes around where we live. And occasionally when we're on vacation, we'll find a place to go on a long walk if we're at the seashore, or we'll find a place to hike if we're somewhere else. So my daughter opened my eyes to how people her age or finding God in the natural world. And that really became one of the sources of inspiration for the book Grounded. And it taught me so much that, yeah, sure, you know, you can find God in a church if that's how you've been trained to find God. And also you can find God in church, because sometimes we wander into these amazing buildings and there's a sense of sacred space that's overwhelming, or there are prayers that have sort of hung around in the old wood and the, you know, sort of the atmosphere of the church for generations, and you can walk into the building and you can feel that. And you can find God in a sacred building, but you can also find God in these other places. And the two things have to be in conversation with one another right now. And so my daughter and her friends have taught me a lot about the conversation that didn't come naturally to me. Mm-hmm. And that was the conversation about God in the world.
It's really the visceral experience of God, isn't it?
It really is. And if we open our eyes, and we have that sort of, a friend of mine is always talking about how we have to have soft eyes that the wide periphery of seeing. So we see towards the edges and see towards the horizons that aren't natural to us. If we have that capacity to live with our eyes open in that way, I do believe that the sacred, that God, can be seen, discovered, felt, and experienced in surprising ways. And that reality, the reality of that experience, should shape our characters, should shape the way we practice faith, should shape the way we treat others, and certainly can and should shape the way we engage in justice in the world.
Absolutely. My guest this evening, Diana Butler Bass. She's the author of Grateful, The Transformative Power of Giving Thanks. So we're going to get into the book in the next segment. Diana, please tell our listeners where they can get the book and find out more about you and your work.
Grateful and Grounded, both, are available on Amazon and through Barnes & Noble. Any major bookseller in the United States can certainly order it for you. And I always encourage people, check out your local independent bookstore and see if they can get you a copy. Because if you help support local booksellers, your community is enriched.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. The little brick and mortar business in your community, those are the ones that you need to really support and sustain. And if you walk in and say, I'd like to get a copy of Grateful or Grounded by Diana Butler Bass, and they say, we don't have it, they say, well, order it for me. I'll wait. You'll get it for me. Right? That's what we want to instill in our communities.
Absolutely.
And we'll be back with more of Diana Butler Bass after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Hi, this is Sylvia Henderson, intuitive life coach and energy healer. Are you ready to elevate and rise way above your normal? Be sure to listen to my show, Intuitive Transformations, on Om Times Radio, Sunday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. Get the inspiration you need to transform your life.
What does Meals on Wheels do? They deliver meals and smiles to homebound seniors. But Meals on Wheels does something else. They turn a volunteer's lunch break into a meaningful experience.
As small and as simple as a relationship is between a volunteer and a client of Meals on Wheels, it's really so impactful. I never thought that 5 minutes could make so much difference in the lives of two people, but it has.
Drop off a warm meal and get more than you expect. Volunteer at AmericaLet'sDoLunch.org. That's AmericaLet'sDoLunch.org. Brought to you by Meals on Wheels America and the Ad Council.
This is Terry Van Horn, and I want to invite you to join me for my weekly radio show, Healing Light, on Om Times Radio, every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. On Healing Light, we want to bring love, light, and blessings into your world. You can find out more about us at www.healinglightonline.com. Blessings.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this evening, Diana Butler Bass. She's the author of Grateful, The Transformative Power of Giving Thanks. Diana, you open Grateful with the story about receiving a thank you note for a thank you note that left you not knowing if you should respond with another note back. You know, it reminds me of that old thing, I'm thanking me for thanking you for thanking me for thanking you ad nauseum. What did you end up doing?
Oh, I ended up sort of just befuddled and not saying anything else. So I did not write the thank you note for the thank you note that I'd gotten as a thank you note. I thought, okay, the chain just has to stop here. And so I remember, as I write in the book, literally tossing the thank you note on a pile of papers and thinking, okay, this is so confusing. How can we really be grateful? And so it was something I've never forgotten, and I always thought was a little funny, but this book gave me a chance to explore the kinds of conundrums we get into by not understanding what it means to live a truly thankful life.
Now, you honestly share that gratitude had been a struggle for you. How so?
The first chapter of the book, although the title changed in the final copy, the first chapter is now called Confession, No Thanks. The very first version of that chapter was called Confessions of an Ingrate. And I just wasn't ever very good at doing the things that my parents expected me to do in order to be grateful. You mentioned at the beginning that you grew up in a time where your parents insisted, you know, on being kind and expressing that kind of gratitude to other people. And so did my parents. You know, if somebody holds a door open for you, you say thank you. If a teacher has gone out of his or her way for you, you take them a small gift. If you get a present from your grandparents, you write a thank you note. And so my parents were mannered people, and they taught me to do all those things, and I just was bad at it. I just would forget. And so my mom and I wound up having arguments about, have you written that thank you note to your grandparents? No, Mom, I don't know what to write. And she'd say, here, sit down, write. And she would put a piece of paper in front of me with a pen, and I would draw a blank. Maybe that was my first experience of writer's block. when I would just look at that paper and I would say, you know, dear Mimi, that was my grandmother's name, dear Mimi and grandfather, thank you. And then I'd look at my mom and I'd say, what else am I supposed to write? And she'd say, write what's on your heart. And I said, well, I just did. And so we would get in these little quarrels, and I got to a point where I just thought, this is hopeless. And I think my mom thought I was hopeless too, because what she wound up doing was Christmas, I was either 14 or 15 years old. I, you know, went to the tree and I was opening my presents, and there was a hardback book. Ooh, I could tell, you know, because it's hard to hide one of those when you've wrapped it. And so I pick up this book. I'm all excited. You know, what kind of great novel is my mom giving me, or a book of poetry or whatever? I rip the paper off, and lo and behold, it's Miss Manners. And not only was it Miss Manners, but my mom had put a bookmark in the chapter that said how to write thank you notes. Mm-hmm. And I've often thought it was the most passive aggressive present I ever got, but really it wasn't passive at all. It was completely aggressive. My mom was just saying, do this. So I kind of gave up. You know, I didn't do it the way my mom wanted me to do it. And so I thought, well, maybe I just am no good at this. And so in the book, I talk about how I had sort of, by the time I was a late teenager, early young adult, I sort of had consigned myself to the life of being a gratitude klutz.
Now, I know you made many attempts to bring gratitude into your life and that of your family. Why do you think it was so important for you to get that?
Well, eventually, there were a couple of things that prompted me to go back and explore this as a practice. One of them was the thing I was just talking about when I wrote the book Grounded. To write a book about finding God in nature and neighbor leaves open a really interesting question. If God is here with us in the world, then what's next? You know, what are the sort of spiritual practices that frame up that experience? Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking about that, and I kept running into, I've always thought that practices of hospitality were extraordinarily important, practices of doing justice, that those are very important. But I kept running into this idea of practice and gratitude. You know, it just showed up in the peripheral vision of me looking at God in the world. And so everything from, you know, happening to run into some interesting scientific study about how gratitude is good for us, or watching Oprah and listening to a really interesting interview with someone who is a researcher in gratitude. So I kept running into it. And then I was, you know, heading into my mid-late 50s. I just turned 59 as a couple of weeks before the book came out. And I was thinking about the people that I know who are older than me, who I consider to be models and friends, and who live lives that are good examples of the kind of life that I would like to live for the next 20 or 25 or 30 years, however long I have left here in this part of the sojourn. And I realized that the people I most admired were people who had strong practices of gratitude. And I realized I didn't really have that. And two of those friends, one was this amazing New Testament scholar by the name of Marcus Borg, and another woman was a person who wrote about spirituality and mostly about prayer, a woman by the name of Phyllis Tickle. They were both amazing writers, very, very good personal friends of mine. They died within a year of one another. Marcus was in his early 70s and Phyllis in her early 80s. And they were two of the most amazing people that I have ever known in my life when it came to practicing gratitude. And their deaths really gave me pause. And I thought, okay, they're speaking to me out of their lives, and now from having gone ahead, that this is something I need to explore. So I went back and I started thinking about how being grounded and being grateful are deeply connected to one another, and that the work that I had done on creating a theology around a vision of a grounded life, around an ecologically rich vision of the world and the Spirit of God in the world with us, that it was literally an invitation into stopping my excuses about gratitude. You know, instead of saying, oh, I've just never been very good at it, or I'm kind of a klutz, or, you know, maybe I'm just a little bit of an ingrate. No, my own life called me to explore this topic. So,
yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So I think that for me, people have asked me, you know, what's different about this book than the, this is my 10th book. And I said, you know, I looked back at what I have written over the last 17 or 18 years, and I realized that almost every other book I wrote was a book where I was trying to help other people live well in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And this book is the first book that I've ever written that wasn't about helping somebody else, but it was about helping myself.
Wow. Wow. Light bulb time, right? Aha moment.
Yeah, it really was powerful when I got to that place. My husband watch me struggle as I wrote it. This was not an easy book. I'm not a gratitude expert. I don't have a PhD in social psychology or any of the things that are the fields that feed into an academic study of gratitude. Every other book I've written in my life, I have expertise in all of those things: church history, spirituality, social trends, theology. I have degrees in all that stuff. I know that stuff backwards and forwards. I can stand in a room and I can lecture on those things for, you know, an hour or two without a single note. And so all of my other books have been written out of a deep sense of my own authority. This book was written out of a deep sense of my own inadequacy and wanting to go on a journey to a place I hadn't been before and discover new things. And after I wrote it, my husband said, you know, writing that book has saved you.
How did you feel when he said that?
I just looked at him and I said, you know, you're right.
In your exploration of gratitude and doing this work and writing this book, a lot of the things that you discussed, your expertise, a lot of those are intellectual pursuits. Gratitude, in my experience, We talked about being a visceral experience with religion. Is a visceral thing, to be thankful and grateful and feel it inside. Are you starting to feel it, or have you been feeling it now?
Yes, and I learned that I had always felt it, which was really a joy when I got there, because that quarrel that I had with my mother, she had a very distinctive idea of what gratitude should be. And for her, gratitude was this expression of appreciation, whereby if you received a gift, you acknowledged that to another human being. And that had a formal structure for my mother. And so my mother, really, if you would have asked her, what is gratitude? She would have said, it's returning thanks for a gift that you have been given. And she, like I said, she had this idea that you gave a gift back. You made sure your appreciation was expressed. You said public thank you to whoever gave you the gift. And you wrote a thank you note. Those things were for her gratitude. All along, what I did not realize is I was having great... The reason I couldn't put down what I was feeling on paper to write a thank you note to my grandparents is that I felt so deeply moved by their presence that I didn't have words to put around my feelings.
You had the struggle of trying to intellectualize something that you were feeling inside.
Yeah, and I was trying to ritualize something that I felt, you know, by the ritual of the thank you note. And the words seemed so deeply inadequate. I mean, I loved my grandparents, and especially my grandmother, who I write about in the book, loved giving presents. And she gave the most glorious presents. I didn't care when I was a little kid about Santa Claus coming. I cared about my grandmother showing up on Christmas Eve. Because my grandmother would come with an entire car full of the most thoughtful, beautiful, amazing, perfectly wrapped presents that could ever be imagined by a little girl. I was in awe of my grandmother in that way.
My guest, Diana Butler Bass, she's the author of Grateful, The Transformative Power of Giving Thanks, and we'll be back with more of Diana after these words on the Olden Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello! Join us, Lisa Berry and Michelle Carter, every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for the Mindset Makeover, What's Possible? Get ready to become present, clear, and unstuck, and start living fully, led by your heart, while you listen and feel this transformation through vibration of word, sound, and song. You'll open up to what's possible and experience your shift.
To buy your home, you became a house hunting ace. Learned about loans, scoured neighborhoods, and asked the right questions. Now you're queen of your castle. If you manage that, you can get your retirement plan on track. Visiting aceyourretirement.org can help. With 401k tips and smart saving strategies, you'll feel empowered to own your retirement like you own your home. Go to aceyourretirement.org. Because when it comes to clearing financial hurdles, you're an ace. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Join parents and experts at understood.org, a free online resource about learning and attention issues designed to help you help your child thrive in school and in life. Understood.org, because understanding is everything. Brought to you by understood.org and the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this evening, Diana Butler Bass. She's the author of Grateful, The Transformative Power of Giving Thanks. Diana, you talk about what you call the gratitude gap, that perhaps there's a gap between what we say publicly in surveys about gratitude and how we personally feel. What did you find?
The part of what inspired the book, besides my own personal struggle and that deep call I was feeling to become a better person in my late 50s, also came from the fact of survey research. And I love following social trends. I pay attention to data. I was thinking about writing a book about character, just a sort of more general book on character. So I was watching different kinds of surveys that were being done about aspects of character, joy, kindness, doing good, charity, and gratitude was just one of the things I was beginning to pay attention to. In November of 2015, there were these two surveys that appeared back to back, and they became the framework for the book eventually. The first survey was by Pew Research Center. They ask a question: have you in the last week felt a strong sense of gratitude? And the answer was 78% of Americans said they had. And I looked at that survey and my eyes nearly popped out of my head, because 8 out of 10 Americans say they felt strongly grateful. And I knew just enough about gratitude to know that was an extraordinarily high number. And it made me sort of stop and wonder, because everybody says gratitude is good for us and makes us better people, makes us happier, healthier, all that kind of stuff. And I really began to wonder, if 8 out of 10 of us feel strongly grateful, shouldn't Americans be a lot happier and less stressed than we are? So I thought there was something kind of a little strange about the number. And then just a few days later, a second survey came out. And this one was by a group called Public Religion Research. And it was not a survey on gratitude, but instead it was on the emotional complexity of the American electorate going into the 2016 election. So both surveys, late 2015, 3 days apart in their release. And the Public Religion Research survey said that Americans were angrier, less hopeful, and more divided than ever. And so those two surveys literally sat on my desk together. And I looked at one. 8 out of 10 of people say that they feel deeply grateful. And I knew that gratitude was supposed to make us better people, happier, less depressed, less stressed, healthier, all those things. And yet this other survey was the survey where in the high 60s and low 70s, people were confessing to that organization that they were angry, depressed, not hopeful, and they didn't trust their neighbors. And so I thought, well, how can these two things exist side by side? And that's what I call in the book the gratitude gap. And what I argue in the book is that we haven't really grasped the full depth and the multidimensional reality of gratitude. So that when a survey taker asks us, have you felt grateful? We might say, oh yeah, you know, somebody held the door for me, or somebody was nice for me, or somebody loaned me $5 so I could get lunch when I left my wallet at home, or whatever, you know. So yeah, sure, I felt grateful. That we usually have assigned gratefulness to some sort of sense of material reward or benefit. And oftentimes we've privatized it very deeply. You know, it's just a feeling that I had for some sort of random act. But that we have not really let gratitude be what it should be. And that is, it's a deeply robust set of both feelings and actions. It is feelings. I was right about that when I was a little girl. It is feelings, but it's also our actions in response to those feelings. So my mother was right to try to help me put rituals and words around those feelings. And that it should never be just private, but that it also needs to express itself in community. And so gratitude is both a personal thing and it's also a public response. And so I try to bring readers, I actually bring readers, I brought myself to a place of understanding the multidimensionality and the power of gratitude as I walked into that gap that I saw between those two surveys. And in that multidimensionality, I think there is such incredible wisdom and deep personal power for living a life of meaning right now in these difficult circumstances in which we find ourselves, that gratitude really can overcome fear and hopelessness and anger and division if we let it.
There are many psychological studies that show that gratitude can impact our lives in very profound ways. Some say that it actually changes the brain chemistry, and that practicing gratitude can have a lasting impact on not just changing people's attitudes, but also enhancing mental health and even helping people to overcome such things as addictions. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I loved that body of literature. Again, these are things I was not an expert on, and I learned how to read medical literature and psychological studies as I was doing this work. And it was so exciting because of that neuroscience piece. Fear and these very primal things that we carry around as human beings, that come from the most ancient part of our brains, the amygdala, the reptilian part of our brain that's deep in the back of our heads. Though fear resides back there, and gratitude actually stimulates the neocortex, which is the part of our brain that is most recently evolved. And is the part of our brain that human mammals have that some other mammals don't share. And so gratitude lives in the neocortex. Fear lives in the reptilian part of our brain. And the scientific studies actually show that if your neocortex is activated by gratitude, it limits where the fear can go. And so without gratitude, the reptilian part of our brain, what's happening there, that brain chemistry can spread through our whole brain. All of a sudden we think, oh my gosh, the saber-toothed tiger is coming right at us. We have to run away, you know, or whatever it is. So fear leads to flight or fight. And so we act like early, very primitive humans. But if gratitude is in play, it gives us the possibility of looking at the whole scene differently. And so when something comes toward us, we don't respond initially with fear, but there's literally a screen that has been put between the reptilian part of our brain and this sort of higher functioning part of our brain, where we can say, okay, what's really going on here? Is this something I need to be afraid of? Oh, no, this person is trying to help me. Or this person isn't coming at me with a gun. This person is coming at me with a gift. Mm-hmm. And so it slows down our reactions, gives us the chance to reflect, pause, consider, see more widely, and then act in a more gracious and open way to what might otherwise be an initial instinct of fear. And so that is what changes our brain chemistry, is that capacity to function out of the neocortex and to live more truly humanly, as it were, with one another, and not simply responding out of fear, out of protectiveness, out of the more primal emotions that we needed centuries ago.
Do you think that's one of the benefits of a practice of gratitude, that it really becomes not just about me, but about we?
Yes, it's absolutely one of the strengths of it. And the more we practice living in that part of our brain, the more we're strengthening that part of our brain. And so practice literally makes our brain chemistry different. And so fear recedes. It doesn't mean that if you're a grateful person or if you have a good gratitude practice that you're never going to be afraid. You know, we're human beings. We are going to be afraid. But it means we process fear differently. And that gives us the potential of not just moving out of the worst impulses of human nature, but being afraid, accepting that, and then being able to move on and make choices. And so practice strengthens that capacity to live better.
My wife and I had the privilege of seeing, we rarely get out to a movie, but we saw a rom-com last week. It's a new movie called All I Wish. And in the movie, there's a character named Darla, played by an actress by the name of Liza Lapira, and she does a soliloquy about wishing to fill what she describes as all the holes in her life. And she goes on to say that instead of wishing that these blanks or empty spaces be filled, she starts expressing gratitude for them. And as she does, she realizes that all she wished for was already there.
Oh, that's beautiful. It echoes the line of one of my favorite poets, Wendell Berry, in one of the poems that I love most deeply, says, "Everything we need is here."
Mm.
And that line has almost become holy scripture to me, because that's what gratitude ultimately leads you to, is the idea and the reality that we live in a universe that is uniquely and beautifully gifted, that it is truly a universe of abundance, and that we are surrounded by everything we need to live with love and compassion with one another. It doesn't deny the reality of suffering, and there's a lot in my book about suffering, but it reframes suffering into a universe of abundance and love. And that's a reframing we desperately need.
Absolutely. My guest, Diana Butler Bass, the author of Grateful, The Transformative Power of Giving Thanks. Diana, please, one more time, tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about your work.
My book can be purchased through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any bookseller, big or small, anywhere in North America. People can follow me on Twitter and Facebook. I love being on Twitter. Please join me there. And I have a website where people can get more information about my work at DianaButlerBass.com.
And Diana, we are grateful for you joining us tonight and sharing this wonderful book and your wonderful message. Thank you so much.
Victor, it has been a complete pleasure to meet you tonight. And thank you for letting me share some things that are so dear to my heart.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.